I'm actually not going to present one single piece, and I'm actually not even going to present all of my own work. So most of the work I'm presenting here are drawn from either from work that I've done in many cases with colleagues, as well as work with my colleague Lee Badgett, who is part of I'm at the Williams Institute at UCLA School of Law, and Lee and I both work there. And Lee's an economist, and I'm kind of an economist demographer. So much of this work draws from both of our work. We know in general that economic conditions are strongly correlated with both physical and emotional well-being. Basically, having more resources makes you easier to get health care. It diminishes stress around having a lack of resources. So that literature is fairly well known. And we've talked a lot about then how does that work with marriage. And as has already been mentioned, there's this debate about a selection versus treatment argument. So is marriage to people, you know, who are economically better off or will be, do they select into marriage, or does marriage have some causal effects on well-being? And most of the literature argues, I think, at this point that it's both things happen. It's really not an either or, that in fact there's evidence for both of those things. And furthermore, there's evidence of selection, both positive and negative selection. So that can be a fairly complicated argument. But I would make the argument that from a policy perspective, that when we look at marriage laws and what marriage laws do for people, they generally are designed to provide some level of economic advantage to married individuals and their families. And examples of this are, in our country, marriage is very much tied to access to health care. So if you're married and you work, your access to health care is different, and inexpensive access to health care for your spouse is very different than if you're in a relationship where you're not married. Marriage gives people different choices in terms of healthcare decision making, particularly in times of crisis. So in the absence of marriage, in a time of crisis, it's not always clear who can make decisions for you. In the presence of marriage, that's very clear, and that arguably could have effects on your own personal health, depending on who is making those decisions. And finally, marriage laws in general provide, without going into any detail, provide easier transfer of assets, again, in times of crisis. So in either the dissolution of the marriage or at the death of a spouse, marriage laws make the kind of that transition. And as well, it also arguably makes a more equitable transition in terms of access to your children. Again, at the time of dissolution, and how do you negotiate that? Marriage provides a platform to do that, arguably in a healthier and, in most cases, perhaps a more agreeable way than in the absence of marriage. So I'm going to, as I said, draw on studies from a variety of findings, and I am, as you can tell, I'm going to go low-tech. I don't have a PowerPoint. To look at what we know about the economic situation of same-sex couples and try to make some inference around how marriage would affect that situation. To start, I'm a demographer, so the first question always, well, how many are there? In the United States right now, our estimate is that there's, if you use the findings from the American Community Survey, there's about 780,000 same-sex couples. These are couples where one partner, they're of the same sex, and one partner is identified as either the husband, wife, or the unmarried partner of the other. To give you some perspective, that's about 1% of all couples in the United States. Men in same-sex couples generally earn less than married men. This is one of the most pervasive stereotypes about gay men, is that they're rich. And in fact, almost every economic study of gay men, whether it's men in same-sex couples or gay men in general, finds that that is not the case. They either make similar to, or in most cases, less than other men. In the case of men in same-sex couples, they make substantially less than married men, to the tune of about $32,500 in income for men in same-sex couples versus $38,000 median income for men in married couples. The picture for women is quite different. In fact, most studies show that lesbians actually earn more than other women, or at the very least don't earn less. And women in same-sex couples have median earnings of about $28,600 versus $21,000 for women in married couples. And we can have lots of debates about why that is for women, but it is a fairly persistent finding. In general, in the United States, we find that between 20 and 25% of same-sex couples are raising children. So a non-trivial group of these folks are raising children. However, I think there's huge amounts of stereotypes around what those couples look like, and I'll talk a little bit later specifically about these couples with kids, because I think that's one of the areas where the potential economic impacts of marriage can be in play. I did a study that's just been published in Demography that looks specifically, and you'll hear about some of these other data in Natalia's study, who will present after me, but we looked at same-sex couples specifically in California. This is from work I did with Christopher Carpenter. And in we find that there's about 109,000 same-sex couples, and about a quarter of them are raising children. But interestingly, large portions of self-identified gay and lesbian people are in cohabiting or even non-cohabiting partnership relationships. So we found that about 10% of gay and lesbian identified men and women are in a cohabiting relationship, or they're in a partnership relationship where they're not cohabiting. And additionally, around 40% of gay men and upwards of 60% of lesbians are in cohabiting relationships. That puts lesbians at par with heterosexual women. So they're about, in California, they're about as likely to be in a cohabiting partnership or marriage as their heterosexual counterparts. I think that's, again, another kind of stereotype. Now, what's interesting, there are some fairly different big differences in addition to the partnership thing. As I think Esther's study found, the gay men actually were in longer duration relationships than their lesbian counterparts. So lesbians are more likely to be in a couple, but gay men who are in a couple have longer duration relationships. And I'm frequently asked, why do you think that is? And one of my short answers to that, which doesn't do justice to the full issue, but if you look at men and women in general in surveys, women say they want to be married more than men, and women initiate breakup more often than men. So these data would be consistent with that idea, that women will form relationships more often, but they'll also break up more often. What's, I think, cogent to this discussion with this study is that we were able to look at differences between people in registered partnerships relative to those who are not. And again, as Esther has pointed out, they're 2-to-1 female. Women much more predominant in among registered partnerships. The duration, just to give you a sense, for men, for both men and women, those in registered partnerships were in longer duration relationships. For men, it was 12 years versus 9.6 for those not registered. And for women, it was 9 years versus 8 years. Men in registered partnerships relative to those not tended to be higher educated, have higher income, and were actually less likely to have children. Women were more likely to have children if they were in a registered partnership, and they had much fewer differences on education and income. So there didn't seem to be as big of, whether you call it selection or treatment, there didn't seem to be as big a difference for the women. As I mentioned, I think that one of the areas of research on gay people that is, again, in the public perception, much subject to stereotype is around child rearing. And unfortunately, I think some of that is as a result of what kind of research we've done on child rearing. The vast majority of studies on child rearing by gay and lesbian people focus, certainly of late, have focused more or less on intentional child rearing. So adoption, those kinds of reproductive technologies. And I think largely as a result of that, they tend to focus on higher income, predominantly white gay and lesbian people in those studies. Adoption and reproductive technologies are expensive. Poor people can't do that as easily. And what that does is, and it's not by any way to diminish those findings, but the truth of gay and lesbian parenting is that the vast, vast majority of gay people parenting did not do it through either adoption or perhaps reproductive technologies. Evidence from the census and from the American Community Survey is that most of childbearing among, certainly in same-sex couples, is probably from prior relationships. And so now it's kind of, these kids are part of set family relationships. And to give you some sense of that, one of the most important findings around that is that African Americans and Latinos and Latinas in same-sex couples are 2 to 3 times more likely than their white counterparts to be raising children. It's dramatically different. And it's true. That's true even if you look in the California data we have at gay and lesbian identified people regardless of their coupling status. They're much more likely to have had children. Does anybody know the state where same-sex couples are most likely to be raising children? Thank you. It's Mississippi. And a part of that is due to, again, that states that have, in general, you see same-sex couples raising children where other people raise a lot of children, and often, as I said, in states that have relatively high non-white populations. My short story on that is that I think people who come out later in life, and those are people who live in socially conservative areas or perhaps are part of some minority communities which can be sometimes more socially conservative, people who come out later in life are more likely to have kids earlier in life. And so I think that's, while that's not the only explanation, it's probably one of the explanations for this. So because of this difference, 2/3 of couples raising kids live in states that have second parent adoption, and I can assure you that a larger portion of them, much larger, live in states that don't have any kind of marriage or other kinds of legal recognition. A disproportionate portion of them do relative to the population. Couples raising kids are substantially economically disadvantaged relative to their married counterparts. So to give you a sense, in the 2000 census, median household income of same-sex couples raising kids was $46,200 versus their married counterparts, which was nearly $60,000. So dramatic differences in income. And it is persistent. We've done that at the state level in virtually every state. It's the exact same thing. Same-sex couples raising kids. Now, part of that is because it's two female incomes for a larger group in the same-sex couples than in the married couples, which are all male-female incomes. But that doesn't fully explain it when the analysis we've done. There's clear evidence that they're economically disadvantaged. So what effects might marriage have on couples and couples with kids? Well, one of the first and important things is that, as I've said earlier, marriage is linked to access to health care. And in a study that my colleague Lee Badgett did, they found that approximately 20% in those in same-sex couples do not have health insurance. That's double the rate of married couples. In married couples, it's only about 10% who lack health insurance. And that access, clearly, to partner health insurance can reduce the non-insured, if you provided universal access to domestic partner benefits, their estimate is that you would reduce the number of uninsured by a half among unmarried couples. So it would have, and arguably marriage could do that. Marriage would essentially create an equitable way for same-sex couples to get these access. I say arguably because some argue that that's not completely true, and I think there's valid. But broadly, the estimate then is that you would reduce that by a half. There's also pretty substantial tax inequalities, and most of them, a few of them, a very small few, favor not getting married. We've all heard about the marriage penalty when you file joint, but largely the tax differences would reduce spending for same-sex couples. So, for example, with health care insurance, if I cover my same-sex partner, the cost of that health insurance is considered taxable income for me in most, even in states that have marriage on a federal level. And for the average couple, they spend on average $1,000 more per year than their married counterparts on health insurance for their partner. It also potentially changes, again, your healthcare access to children, and because of marriage creates differences as to how you're related to those kids potentially. And there's some evidence, although I've not seen any great research on that particular thing, to say how access would be improved. But nonetheless, it's a clear kind of economic benefit to same-sex couples in that domain to get married. And there's some very clear examples of the cost of marriage inequality to families with children. So, for example, a gay and lesbian parent who earns $60,000 a year and receives health insurance, and this is very similar to the last example, for his or her partner will pay $875 more in taxes than married couples with kids. If a gay and lesbian parent earns $60,000 in the last year of his or her life and leaves a partner and, let's say, a 10-year-old child behind, the family would lose almost $250,000 in Social Security survivor benefits because, in part, the child might, if that wasn't the birth child of the partner who died, they don't necessarily have access to that survivor benefit. So in that particular scenario, it would be about $250,000 over the lifetime. And perhaps one of the biggest things around parental rights and marriage is that parental rights establish ways in which parents have, again, can make healthcare decisions not only for their partners, but for their kids. And in that absence, that gets much more complicated. And even though there's lots of evidence that even partners who have created all the various legal documents, the truth is you walk into a hospital, they say, are you the parent of that kid? You say no, and they say too bad. And you can show them all the documents you want, and we have lots of examples of that, and it's marriage makes a difference in that regard. So there's many, many who believe that marriage for same-sex couples, while it might not instantly solve those problems, it could definitely create a more level playing field. So I'm actually going to close there, and I will mention one other. I have about a minute left. I will mention one other interesting study, which we've. I was just at a presentation this week by Ellen Riggles and some colleagues, where they've actually looked at the health effects not of marriage but of propositions, and of putting these kinds of things on the ballot, and they find some pretty dramatic negative health consequences, both for same-sex couples and for gay and lesbian people in general. They find that in states that have had these kind of high-profile ballot initiatives, it increases negative contact with other people, with family, with friends. It in the various court rulings, the last two that are out, in the California and the Connecticut decisions, there was a strong, the courts took a strong stance on what they called a dignitary harm. When you don't have access to marriage, when you call it something else, it creates a dignitary harm. For instance, if you're in a civil union and someone, you introduce your partner, you essentially have to self-disclose. Because you're in a, quote, civil union, so if you're on a form, you know, where it's not about the sex of the partner, you have to kind of self-disclose in a way that others don't. But they also found, as I said, a variety of kind of negative health consequences to having these kind of high-profile debates, and argue that it's a public health problem in the community. So with that, I will close. Thank you very much. Thank you.